It's 10:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a quote from an article in the September 28th edition of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Despite intense efforts driven by the No Child Left Behind Act, the language abilities of our 17-year-olds have remained stuck at the steeply declined levels of the 1970s, while the language gap between white students on one side and black and Hispanic students on the other remains distressingly and immovably large, unquote. My guest is the author of the article, and he contends that the kind of failure he's describing is putting our democracy at risk. E.D. Hirsch is Professor Emeritus of Education and Humanities at the University of Virginia. He is founder and chairman of the Core Knowledge Foundation and author of Cultural Literacy and The Schools We Need and Why We Don't Have Them. He is also a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the International Academy of Education. Good morning, Professor Hirsch, and welcome to the program.
Thanks. And you might put in a plug for the book that just came out.
Go ahead and do that.
Which is The Making of Americans. That's the latest thing, and it's everybody says the best, so I thought I would. You know what Gilbert and Sullivan said, if your merits you're bound to enhance. If you don't blow your own trumpet, you haven't a chance.
Well, we will provide you with several other opportunities to do just that, Professor. Let's start out with a more abstract question. What is the connection between language skills and a strong democracy?
Well, first of all, the phrase language skills can itself be very misleading because it sounds as though those are sort of separable skills that you can deploy on any subject matter. You can read, speak, understand anything if you have language skills, but that's not quite accurate. And it's been a grave misfortune that we've taken that skills or how-to approach to language ability. In fact, language ability it depends on very broad knowledge, a lot of it of an academic type. And so the big problem, if you lack language skills, is that you lack knowledge. That's the key point, and that the gap between these groups in language scores and language ability is a knowledge gap. And you can take it a step further. I mean, the importance of it is that if this language and knowledge gap exists, it reflects an earnings gap also. That is, that there's a if you equate language abilities, on average, you're equating income or earnings as well.
Okay, well, help me understand this, because I'm apparently feeling a little obtuse on this Monday morning. The relationship between the difference between language abilities and language skills and how that works. In my case, my mother, God bless her, began to teach me words at a very early age, and by the time I got to kindergarten, I had to learn a new word and be able to spell it and use it in a sentence, and I got a new one every day. And now some people might call that child abuse, but I was given a great number of words. In fact, I got in trouble with my first grade teacher, who thought I was using words I could not possibly know the meaning of. And my mother said, well, is he using them incorrectly? And my teacher said, well, no. Well, then what's the problem? But the point is, I knew a lot of words, and I still know a lot of words. But that doesn't mean that I know what to do with them. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, no. It's perfectly true that, first of all, let's start with your anecdote, because, in fact, this is one of the big problems, is that children, and we know from the work of Betty Hart and Scott Risley, that children enter kindergarten with huge diversities of vocabulary, and generally correlated with income and the level of education of the parents. And one of the aims of the schools is to overcome these huge gaps, which we haven't been able to do. So that's one thing I would say about. But another point, going back to what I originally said, is that these big vocabulary differences among children and very young children are not just vocabulary differences. They're also differences in knowledge. That is, kids who can use some of these words, especially when you're dealing with nouns, have to know the things that the nouns are referring to, which was just your point, wasn't it, that you really did know what those words meant?
Well, part of that was because, now, neither one of my parents went to college, but they were both, I should say my mother still's alive. My father passed away in 1996, but they were both very well-read and very curious intellectually, and books were always a part of our home. Both my mother and father had significant libraries. I was encouraged to read a lot and was subjected to a great debate because my father was a Republican and my mother was a Democrat. So I got a lot of intellectual stimulation at home. I think what you're suggesting is that there are a lot of circumstances in today's culture where that kind of stimulation is not taking place.
Well, that's definitely true. My emphasis is on what the schools can do about that. The home is awfully important, and the trouble is that in American society, the home has been almost all important in determining academic outcomes. And I think that's something our democracy doesn't want. We would like the schools to make more of a difference.
So if we talk about knowledge of what? What is it that we need more knowledge of?
Well, if you're one of the best and to me most interesting examples of the role of knowledge as distinct from abstract verbal skills was an experiment that was done with kids. I think they were fifth graders who one group scored very well on technical reading abilities, decoding words, accuracy, fluency was all there. The other group was less good at those technical skills, but they knew a lot about baseball. And they were given a text about baseball and then asked to find the main idea, to answer multiple choice questions, to put little counters on the field where things were happening. And of course, the kids who were bad readers but knew about baseball read that text a lot better than the so-called good readers. And that's a very important experiment, which was, by the way, repeated in Europe with kids on the subject of soccer. But the key point is that understanding language and understanding a text implies very much what isn't said as well as what is said. And to understand it, you have to build up a general knowledge about the subject, or you have to already have that, in order to make the right kinds of inferences from what you're reading. So, understanding language is chiefly making inferences about what's being meant. And you can make those inferences. The only way you can do it is if you have some general knowledge, as in baseball, of what the subject matter is.
Well, an inference is, a simple way to put that is, isn't an inference a guess about the unknown based on the known?
That's right. You've hit it right on the head. But it's a guess about the unknown, another way of seeing what the unknown is, that it's a part of a whole situation. For example, if I say John sacrificed and knocked in a run, I could make an inference that there was a runner on third. Might be wrong, might be right. You know, it could have been a long, long hit, or it could have all other things could have happened, and it could have been a runner on second. But the basic point is you're going from the known to the unknown, but only on the basis of knowing typical things about the subject matter.
Well, and there are a lot of things in life that have a lot greater subtlety than baseball, in terms of understanding its rules and the relationships between what one person does and what happens next, and so forth.
Right, you are.
And so you can. It's easy to draw inferences that aren't correct because of misinterpretation of context.
That's right. It's easy to draw inferences that are incorrect. The less, another way of putting it is the less you, it, a reading test, by the way, all these, when people talk about multiple choice tests, they're all of the different distractors in the and answers in multiple choice tests on reading are inferences that you make from the passage that you're given to mm-hmm. to answer. And you're absolutely right that and people have seen it with kids, it's very easy to get the wrong answer, to make the wrong inference. But if the difference is if somebody knows the subject matter of the passage, they're much more likely to make a correct inference. So reading tests, this is a good illustration why reading tests are not tests of some abstract ability. They're tests of your knowledge of the passage, the subject matter.
Well, I have to say, one of the reasons that I really wanted to do this program is because I've always had a fascination with language and its application and its use and misuse in a number of contexts. And in a part of my other life, I teach part-time public speaking course at a local technical college. And based on our conversation here, I'm having to rethink a few things because I've always suggested that students can improve themselves greatly by doing, for example, the Reader's Digest quiz every month that pays to increase your word power. But I think what I'm hearing here is that the knowledge of language without the ability to reason and to think and to absorb context and interpret it correctly is almost useless.
Well, I would say that's right. To knowledge of language has to be combined with knowledge of things. And if you don't have the knowledge of the world, of nature and culture, you aren't going to be able to use and understand language very effectively. So, in fact, you're right. Those Reader's Digest tests tend to be something of a waste of time. And here's why. Word learning is one of the most amazing faculties of the human mind. We don't know entirely the mechanisms by which it's done, but what we do know is that when you learn a word, you bring away a piece of the context in which you understood that word. So we're carrying around not only detached words in our memories, we're carrying around little bits of context as well from past uses. So meaning and reference and real things are connected to language in the very process of learning words. And if you do that from lists like the Reader's Digest, you don't really learn as much. It's sort of a waste of time.
Let's take a quick phone call here before we go to our break. Kurt in Superior, you'll be our first caller today. Good morning, Kurt.
Good morning. Great show, gentlemen. Really enjoying the dialogue here. Mr. Munson, you're speaking about the heritage in your home and how you were trained by your mother and father through education and debate to appreciate words and to use language. And the good professor seems to be putting a lot of weight on the school system and their responsibility. And I'm wondering what his research found about where the home plays in and how a stronger home or a weaker home enabled a student. And I'll listen for my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt. Professor, let's hold that answer until after we come back from our break. We need to take a break and stay on schedule here, but we will come back to that. The research showing the importance of the home, and then what we do about that. I think that's would be a good thing for us to spend a lot more time on as we move forward. I want to invite other people to join our discussion this morning at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also send an email, talk@wpr.org. My guest is E.D. Hirsch, Professor Emeritus of Education and Humanities at the University of Virginia, and his new book is called The Making of Americans. We'll talk more with Professor Hirsch when we return. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Almost 22 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later on today on Talk of the Nation. This coming week on Talk of the Nation, a look on what's on the docket as a new Supreme Court starts a new session. Plus, Richard Benjamin traveled to the whitest places in America to see what life is like under President Obama. And the food fight at the University of Wisconsin, the omnivore's dilemma, and the farmers strike back. All that coming up after 2 o'clock today on Talk of the Nation here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hey, by the way, we're down to another 444 more pledges that we would need to take another day off our fall pledge drive. We've already taken 2 days off thanks to people who've pledged at WPR.org. We really appreciate it. But we need about 444 more people to do that. We can take Wednesday off as well. So go to WPR.org and make that pledge right now. This hour, we're talking about the relationship between language and how it's inculcated into our young people by the educational system and what's going to happen in our democracy moving forward. That's kind of the general part of this. My guest is the author of an article in a recent edition of the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he's very concerned about the students' ability to learn to know things and how their language training affects that and how this is being done and handled in the public school system. My guest is E.D. Hirsch, professor of Americas of Education and Humanities at the University of Virginia, and he's also the author of a number of books, the most recent of which is The Making of Americans. Professor Hirsch, our caller, Kurt from Superior, just before the break, wanted to talk more about, or hear you talk more about, the relationship between what happens in our families and what shows up at the schools. And I know you mentioned this earlier, but I think it bears repeating. And then I want to talk about what you think the schools ought to be doing to maybe make up for some of the things that families aren't necessarily doing for their children.
Right. Well, the classic study, and still valid, was done in the famous Coleman Report back in the 60s about how much gain in verbal ability, particularly, was owing to family background and peer groups, and how much to the school. And it turned out overwhelmingly in American education at the time, that was in the 60s, influence of family and peers was far greater than the influence of the school in academic performance and verbal proficiency. The other finding, though, in that very same report was that for disadvantaged children, schools were vastly more important to them. It made far less difference whether a middle class child went to a good school or a poor school, that is a high-performing or low-performing one. It made a huge difference for disadvantaged kids whether they went to a good school or a bad school. So, as a consequence, the implication of the Coleman Report was divided. The schools make overall less difference than family, but schools can make a tremendous difference for children who are behind. And I think the problem with the Coleman Report was that it was confined to American schools at a particular period, and it happened to be a period when our schools had gotten pretty bad. My own view is we ought to look at how well other school systems have done in narrowing this gap between advantaged and disadvantaged students. And we find that other countries have managed to do quite a good job, places like France or Finland. And I think we need to see why is it that schools have been able to narrow the gap in some places but not in others.
Well, why? Well, let me ask the question. Why is it? And let me preface that by asking, is it because, is one of the reasons because in a lot of other countries, students are grouped by ability and by predicted outcomes?
Well, that's not true in all of these high-performing countries. That's not true, for example, in Japan, where there is not ability grouping in the elementary grades, which are the grades that count for this issue. No, the big difference turns out to be how coherent and productive the school curriculum is across the grade levels. That is, if a teacher can if the second grade teacher can depend on all the first grade pupils having learnt particular things, then the teacher can build on that, and the class can move forward as a whole. Both advantaged and disadvantaged kids can. If you haven't got a coherent curriculum, then what happens is the diversity in ability and background increases over the years, and the teacher's job becomes increasingly difficult, and tracking becomes an absolute necessity. So it's the you see, the differential is built in. If you have an incoherent curriculum that is not cumulative, and that's of course my big shtick. That's what I've been saying for about 30 years now, and there's been some progress in the schools picking up the idea. Yes, we really do need to have a grade by grade core curriculum, which will enable that kind of progress and gap closing to happen.
Well, again, and I hate to use myself as an example here, but I'm the only one in the room. My wife teaches second grade at a local school, and my daughter is a fifth grade teacher. So I'm pretty familiar with most of the education jargon. I have to be able to do that to decode conversations. What I'm constantly hearing is about curriculum meetings and about systems that they're putting in place at all the grade levels and so forth. Is this kind of thing common, or are there still school districts where the teachers, each teacher pretty much decides what it is they're going to teach that year, and that's it?
Well, if your schools in Wisconsin are getting some agreement about what all first grade, core that all first grade classes should have and all second grade classes, that's a huge advance, and it's marvelous. But by and large, over the country, that's not happening.
I can't speak for the whole state. What I'm saying is, so what you're saying is that we need this coherence needs to happen over across multiple districts, and so that everybody's pretty much teaching the same thing.
Well, that's very important if you're in a district where the children are moving from school to school a lot. For disadvantaged kids, something like 70% of disadvantaged kids have changed schools by third grade. So it's really not it's not necessary. If kids all stayed in the same school, it wouldn't be necessary to have it across schools. It would just be necessary to be coherent within the school.
Okay.
But given the huge mobility rates we have for the most vulnerable children, it's a good idea to have it at least across the district.
So we should be looking at this. We should be looking at this nationally, then.
Well, that's right, because there is a high mobility in the United States. Always has been.
Okay.
that gives people the shivers. But my view about getting the shivers because of having a certain degree of commonality, a core of commonality in one grade to another, is that, yes, it's like what Churchill said about the worst of all possible systems being democracy. It just happens to be it's a terrible system, but it's better than the alternatives.
Well, yeah, it's worse. It's the worst system ever, except for all the others that have been tried. Okay, let's take some phone calls here. We have some people who want to join in our discussion, and we should let them because that's what the show is about. Let's start with John in Duluth.
Good
morning, John.
I'm going to modify my question a little, but it seemed implicit to me, if you're talking about building, that you're in support of substantially increasing school years and the length of time so that students do have the core down, but I'd also be interested in what particular subjects that you think are important to concentrate on, and I'll leave it at that and listen after I get off the radio.
John, thanks for that.
There were two questions, one about length of school year, and the other was about the subjects of the curriculum. And as far as the school year goes, I think we need to ensure that what goes on in any class period is something that's productive and and is coherent from one class period to the next and from one year to the next. It's true that higher performing elementary schools in the world do tend to have a somewhat longer school year than we do in Asia. On the other hand, if nothing productive is going on, three times zero is still zero. And
well, it becomes sort of like going to the driving range and simply repeating all your mistakes over and over and over again until they become part of your muscle memory.
Right. We need that caveat. And I'm suspicious of all purely external or extrinsic improvements in school structures, which don't deal with the second part of what the caller asked, which was what do you teach and in what order and how much. I mean, those are the questions that are really essential. And then you can answer those questions. We have tried that actually. If you go to the Core Knowledge website, we've tried to answer those questions very explicitly.
And the Core Knowledge website, I'm going to guess, is coreknowledge.org?
That's right. Yes.
That was an inference I drew.
Yes, you did. Very well.
I even know what a syllogism is. Okay. What about what courses we should be teaching? What about the John's second question? He wanted to know what courses you think ought to be emphasized.
Well, it's not courses, it's subject matters. It's what the courses actually teach. And the subject matters that are key are history, the sciences, and the arts, and math. I mean, just the ordinary subject matters. Then within history, you need to decide how much of what kind of history you're teaching and when. And within science, you need to decide, well, what do you do in first grade and so on. As I say, we've wrestled with those problems, and other people have too, of course. And you can see what our answers are there on the Internet.
Okay. I guess the other thing is the emphasis over the last 20 years really has been on reading. We want to teach children to read because the big question was, why can't Johnny read? And so we started putting a lot of emphasis into reading. We had various federal programs that were supposed to be supporting reading. Title I was the big one. There were a lot of reading specialists that were hired in school districts across the country, and the idea was to not only increase the amount of reading but improve reading comprehension, because that was the key, supposedly, to education. Okay, so I think what I'm hearing you say and what I read in your article is that we were kind of shooting at the wrong target there.
Yes. I'm so glad you brought that up, because a lot of school time has been unfortunately wasted because of the guidelines that were given to the schools. It's not the fault of the schools that they spend a lot of time on, tedious time, on finding the main idea, questioning the author, doing a lot of procedures that are supposed to lead to reading comprehension, whereas what you and I just said at the first part of the discussion was that reading comprehension is really inference. And inference depends on knowing something about the subject matter you're dealing with. It isn't a procedure like a syllogism. It isn't like a syllogism. It's like the baseball example. It's like knowing how baseball works.
Well, and it seems to me it's also about having a number of different experiences of your own to draw on and being able to share the experiences of others through language.
That's right, but that means that you both have a common context or common frame of reference that allows you to communicate, and that common frame of reference or context is knowledge. There's no way you can take knowledge out of the equation, mm-hmm. And so it doesn't help if what you need is more of a general knowledge. It doesn't help you to practice a lot of procedures. And that was the huge mistake that was made.
Okay, here's an email from Liz in Elk Mound. Wouldn't a true democracy encourage the value of knowledge from all cultures in the United States and not just the white culture?
That I think we have to go back to the issue there. Yes, I mean, I don't know what a true democracy would encourage knowledge of and tolerance for all cultures. True. Another question, though, is what do you need to enable a citizen in a democracy to function well in what we would call the public sphere? That's the main duty of schools, is to enable a kid who gets out of school, boy or girl, to be independent, earn money, vote, participate in the political decisions. That's what you want, and that means they have to be proficient in the language that of the public sphere.
Yeah, one of the things you talked about in your article that's a follow-up to this is how some of the, I hate to even use the term founding fathers because it's become something of a cliche and rather meaningless, but the people who were the intellects behind what we now call the United States of America had to say about the kinds of things you're talking about.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think we've lost sight of it. They were terribly worried, the founders, that all republics in past history had broken up, had collapsed because of their internal dissensions. And they were worried the same thing would happen in the United States if we didn't create a common public sphere where people had loyalty to the Union. And that, of course, was the great debate in the Constitutional Convention. You know, what belonged to the federal sphere, what belonged to the states, what belonged to local. And the whole principle, of course, was to protect private life, so you could do what you want as long as you didn't hurt other people. And these delicate balances all depended, the founders thought, on there being a coherent public sphere that all of us had some kind of loyalty to and were able to participate in, including a common language. So that, to me, Noah Webster was the great hero, academic hero of the early republic, because he said, well, we've got to have schools that teach some of these common elements, and we have to have a common language. And so he was our dictionary maker and our school book maker in the early republic. And he understood the need for both of those things very, very clearly.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Tom in Burlington next. Hi, Tom. Thanks for holding.
I believe that Yankee ingenuity was based on the English language. And one of the beautiful things about our language is if you go to bed at night and you dream something, you can wake up the next morning and you can describe it in your language, as opposed to in the Spanish language, they put the noun first and they put the adjectives and everything else after it. What we do in our language, we put the adjectives before the noun. And so if you're going to attack a problem, you define the problem one way from the front on. And this, in my opinion, is the way that you develop your brain, how you think. And how you the language you use to speak in is the language you dream in, and you create in, and with this thing of giving Spanish a lot of airtime and whatever, we're really diminishing ourselves, we're just diminishing ourselves. I grew up in Virginia. I went to schools in Virginia, and my father was a member of the House of Representatives. He won the Carter Harrison Award in debate. And when he would talk in the House, you could hear a pin drop because they all tried to learn how Charlie Boyle would speak. But when I'd come back and forth between Chicago and Washington, I always had to make up for the differences in the school systems. And then, I had to learn Latin, which is a big problem. But what I wanted to ask you was this. I write music, and I'm hoping that what they will do is put music in schools. People learn with music. And it doesn't have to be so complicated where you need to get a school teacher or something. Maybe you can get somebody from the churches or somebody to teach kids how to all the rote stuff they have to learn to learn it through music.
Now, Professor,
there were two sort of domains. One was about music, and the other was about how good the English language is. I'm not interested in in scoring the different national languages, you have pretty darn good schooling and pretty intelligent people in most of the developed literary languages, Spanish included and French included, even Japanese, which I have no knowledge of, whatever. And so I'm not into that, but it is the case that by historical accident, the English language is, or the American English language from Noah Webster, is the medium for discourse in the public sphere. And most people think that we need to make our students competent in that language, both reading, writing, speaking, and listening in standard American English, which is what we're doing right here on this program. And so I'm not into any comparative discussion of languages, but it just happens to be the one we need to deal with is the English language. Secondly, as to music, yes, I agree that music should be part of the curriculum. And if you look at the Core Knowledge website, it is part of the ideal curriculum for American schools.
Let's take a break, and then we'll come back. We have some more callers who want to join us, and I haven't gotten to the end of my list of questions by any means. We're talking about language and how it's taught in the schools, what the knowledge is that's required for us to be good citizens in this republic, and the peril that we face as a democracy if we fail to equip our young people with what they need to operate the controls. My guest is E.D. Hirsch, Professor Emeritus of Education and Humanities at the University of Virginia. We'll be right back and continue our discussion. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's just about 10:45. Coming up after 11 o'clock, of course, Larry Mueller will be in, and he's offering help for frustrated personal computer users in the first segment of his program with his guest, Peter Green of InfoStar in Madison. So if you've got computer problems, hold your calls till after 11, as Larry Mueller will have someone on who can help you. This hour, we're talking about a different kind of language, not machine language, but the language that we use to communicate with one another and the knowledge that's required to properly use that language. My guest is E.D. Hirsch, Professor Emeritus of Education and Humanities at the University of Virginia, and he is the author of a number of books, the most recent of which is titled The Making of Americans. Professor Hirsch, we have more callers who want to join us, so let's go back to the phones and take a call from Bob in Sparta. Bob, thanks for holding.
Good morning. A couple observations before I get to my question. I think that the learning and the inferences relates to what philosopher Eric Fromm had to say about that, and I'll paraphrase that you can't learn something new unless you learn something first. And secondly, there was a famous bank robber who was asked, why did he rob banks? And he said, that's where the money is. And that's the situation with the English language and the Internet. And I'll leave that at that. I did a Google on graduation rates in Milwaukee, and I came up with a list of worst to better of the largest 50 schools districts in the United States, and Milwaukee came up number 4. They were beat out by New York City.
You mean number 4 in being worst or number 4 in being best?
Going from worst to better.
Oh, going from worst to better. So they were near the worst.
Yes, number 4.
I see.
And their graduation rate was 43%, and so I'm wondering about you know, what's the future of Milwaukee when you have 6 out of 10 people going around with no high school education? What's that going to do as far as their income in future years? And what will they do to, you know, social welfare problems? And why are these people electing to get out of school? What is their motivation? Why can't we come up with something that's counter to that choice?
Well, it is very disturbing, and I completely agree with your worry. I do blame the incoherence of the schools for a lot of this. I suspect if you looked at the 60 or 57% that are not graduating, that they come predominantly from poorer families, and their schools have not given them the tools they need to be interested in school or to gain much from school. I think that's one of the chief problems, and I put the source of the problem in the elementary grades, not in the high school years, because if you take care of effective elementary schooling, I predict you'll have far fewer dropouts in the high school, because then you'll be competent to do high school work, and high school work will be a lot more interesting. And certainly these people have enough knowledge to know that in the long run, their earnings will be far greater if they graduate from high school.
Well, what about, at what point here, though, does Maslow's hierarchy come into this? I mean, if you are concerned about your personal safety, if your primary concern is, what am I going to eat when I get home today, or will I be able to? Will we have a home? Will we be living in our car? Will I have any medical care? If you are faced with the stress of a whole lot of what are really life and death issues for a lot of people, how can you be thinking in terms that, you know, how do you go to school then with a mindset that's prepared to absorb anything?
True. But are you saying that 57% of our children are in that?
No, I'm not. But I am suggesting that there are some issues that the schools are going to have a great deal of difficulty in dealing with. What do you tell the teacher then? What does the teacher need to do? The teacher may be the most stable and mature adult individual in that young person's life.
Quite so, and we should encourage these students to stay in school. And I do think that if school had more meaning for these students, that is, if something productive was going on in school for them, they probably would stay in school, even given the context you're talking about.
Let's go to Julie in Manitowoc next. Hi, Julie.
Hi. My cell phone battery is getting low, but I'll try to be quick. I have a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old, and my 5-year-old just seemed to develop language so early on. She could speak in full sentences when she was about 12 months old, and people would just kind of look at her like, oh my gosh, how can that little person be speaking so clearly? And I kind of always wondered if, you know, all the reading we did and just interacting and talking with our children helped develop that sooner, and what we can do to encourage that, you know, the continued development of her language.
You're absolutely right. Your daughter's lucky. And I would also come back, though, to what should we do when children come from homes where they're not so lucky. And there, I think we come back to my big theme, which is what can the schools do in the very early years, the elementary school years, preschool, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, to enhance these the language abilities, and not just the language abilities per se, but also the knowledge that goes with those language abilities. And I think our schools can do a very great deal. And I hope that we'll come round to that point of view, and the biggest thing we can do in the schools to develop these higher language capacities is by being very clear and coherent and interesting in the subject matters that we're teaching these younger kids.
Let's go to Walter, who's in the military. Walter, good morning.
Yes, indeed. How to do, sir? I'm so happy to hear this subject. I add my stick to the pile here. Born in 1941, and by the time I went through 12 years of primary and secondary education, I had been to 24 different schools, one of them three different times, back and forth between the city and the country. And you were talking about context and language earlier. I spoke with people that spoke about all kinds of things, and I got involved in all kinds of physical right there in front of me projects, I think. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last thing you said.
And I, as a kid that went back and forth between city and country, I spoke with a lot of different people and was involved in a lot of different physical projects, things that, you know, were there in front of me that I had to deal with just in the everyday life. And I think a part of your discussion might have something to do with one of the differences between kids is whether they were raised in the city or the country. Country kids have to deal with physical, real-time problems all
the
time.
Uh-huh.
And I think that adds to their educational process. But one of the big things that I found a constant throughout the schools, whenever I was coming through school, was the music. And I personally believe that the music is just incredibly important because it ties, whenever you sing with other people, it ties your spirits together and allows you to be just more cooperative in general.
Yes, well, you're the second person who's emphasized the importance of music, in particularly in early grades, and I agree with it, and we at Core Knowledge agree with it, and have a big musical component in the curriculum. But what has happened, in the last decade under No Child Left Behind, is that practice of reading has pushed out music and art and a lot of other literature, too. And this has been a disaster. And I hope that with a more adequate understanding of what reading really is, how it connects to language as a whole, that people will start emphasizing just having a good education is the best way to make gains in language and in reading.
Mike in Appleton, you're up. Good morning, Mike.
Yeah, two points. I'm calling to kind of refute a previous caller who was trying to make a link between, let's call it, Yankee ingenuity and English. He said something along the lines that if you had a thought while you were sleeping when you woke up in the morning, you would be able to better address that thought if you spoke English versus Spanish. I think in a nutshell, that's what he said.
Yeah.
I'm totally bilingual, English and Spanish. And so, you know, if I go to sleep at night and have a thought, the next morning I can think about it in English or Spanish, and it really doesn't make any difference. The second point I'd like to make as far as education and languages, I think it's absolutely vital in the environment that we live in today that kids apart from English should be fluent in several foreign languages, if at all possible, because, you know, that's where the marketplace is. That's the way the world is today. Thanks.
Yes, you get no challenge from me on that.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left. In fact, we've got about a minute and a half here, Professor, and that's probably not enough time, but make the attempt anyway. What is it at the heart that you want the schools to do that they're not doing now, and how do they get there?
Well, what the schools need to be doing now is have a better definition of the content that they're teaching children in kindergarten, in first grade, second grade, third grade, and that content should be cumulative and coherent, and that's the way to build up not only a good general education for the democracy, but also to build up language abilities. In fact, I would say, as far as the schools go, that's the chief way to build up language abilities, not to practice all of these comprehension exercises and so on. So it's coherent substance.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes. So the quick answer to your question is the schools need to introduce coherent substance into the early grades.
Coherent across regions.
Coherent across subject matters, yes. And coherent and common, yes, common across districts and regions, too, because of this. There's so much mobility in the country.
Well, you know, there's a political debate that I think would make health care look like the opening bout.
It hasn't been done.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate. Professor, thank you for a fascinating hour. I hope everyone else enjoyed it as much as I did.
Well, thanks for having me.
E.D. Hirsch is Professor Emeritus of Education and Humanities at the University of Virginia. He's founder and chairman of the Core Knowledge Foundation and author of Cultural Literacy, The Schools We Need and Why We Don't Have Them, and his most recent book, The Making of Americans. He's also a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the International Academy of Education. This program was produced by Rob Schroeder, and he also handled on-air production along with Rhonda Fanning. If you missed part of it and want to go back to listen again, you can do that by going to our website, WPR.org. And by the way, while you're there, help us take another day off the pledge drive. We've already taken 2 days off, and we're about 400 pledges away from taking a third day off. Go to WPR.org, make your pledge now. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. Larry Mueller up right after this news.